learned that faith is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. We talked about this, of course, Wednesday night. You hope for something, you don't see it, you desire it, you expect it. And all of that wraps up into what faith is all about. And we'll see a lot of examples of that as we go through Hebrews chapter 11. Great Bible characters really gain renown because they live lives of faith. They had a good testimony, the text says. Faith enables us to understand how the world was created out of nothing. We saw the example of Abel offering a more excellent sacrifice than Cain by faith. And we learned that faith is necessary to please God. Enoch was taken from this life to the next without dying because he pleased God. And that pleasing of God, he did because he was a person of faith. A person, in order to please God, must believe two things. He must believe that He is, and that He's a rewarder of those who seek Him. These are important aspects of faith. And then we went on and we talked about Noah, who believed God's warning concerning things he had not seen. He certainly hadn't seen a worldwide flood. He may not have seen rain, probably hadn't seen rain at all. So here's a lot of things that God is telling him are going to happen he hasn't seen. But he moves with godly fear and prepares an ark for the saving of his household. And the contrast between he and the people of his day, who were sinful men, is tremendous. And so by his righteous life, he condemns the world, the text says. And he becomes an heir of righteousness. Then we talk about, a little while Wednesday night, we talk about Abraham, who by faith obeyed when he was called to go to a place that God would give him. And he went out not even knowing where he was going. But he believed that God would give him a place that was promised. He believed that God had an intention for him and an outcome that certainly would be pleasing to him. So he dwells in the land of promise as a foreigner because he waited for the city of God. You see in Hebrews chapter 11, verses 8 through 10. And that sort of brings us to where we left off in Hebrews chapter 11 and verses 11 and 12. By faith, Sarah also received strength to conceive seed, and she bore a child when she was past the age because she judged him faithful who had promised. Therefore, from one man, and him as good as dead, were born as many as the stars of the sky in multitude, innumerable as the sand which is by the seashore. So Sarah, how old is she when she gets the word she's going to have Isaac? 90 years old. 90 years old. So here's a 90-year-old woman. Now, she doesn't take that necessarily without at least a sense that this is odd. It's even, to her, funny, because what does she do? She laughs. But we need to be careful not to think that her laughter there was a lack of faith. I think it may have just been, in her mind, the absurdity of the situation, a woman of her age. But she received strength to bear a child even in her old age. And, you know, that is an act that would take a lot of faith. She was convinced, what about God? Now, He was faithful. He's a promise keeper. He's going to do what He said, even though with men, certainly this is an impossible thing. We can't even hardly imagine any 90-year-old ladies that we know giving birth. I know a few 90-year-old ladies, and it'd be hard to even imagine that. But she believed. She had faith and bore a child. So as a result of that, from one man, and the text says he was as good as dead. How old was Abraham? He's at least 100 then, right? And so here he is, that age, as good as dead. And you wouldn't think, well, you know, he's not going to sire any children. Yet from him come descendants as innumerable as the stars of the heaven and as of the sands of the sea. Amazing faith a woman like Sarah had. Well, let's think about then, as the writer sort of breaks here and wants to talk with us about some general characteristics of these people who live by faith. Certainly this would apply to Abraham and Sarah. But he's pointing out the viewpoint, and the key thing about faith is it's your viewpoint. It's how you perceive reality. Okay? Here's what he says. Look at verses 13, and we'll read through 13 through 16. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off. Now, let me just stop right there. I said I was going to read that, but let me stop right there. They didn't receive the promises, but what does it say? They had seen them afar off. They behaved as if these were real things. Well, they were real things to them. That's what faith is. It's the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. Okay, so to them, these promises were as real as anything there was. Even though they hadn't seen them, and even though, or they hadn't received them, I should say, they did see them by faith. They were assured of them. In other words, how certain were they that the promises which God gave, the promises to Abraham and Sarah of, you know, a multitude of children and a nation that would come and the land that they would inherit, how certain were Abraham and Sarah that those things would be? They were absolutely sure. They were absolutely sure that this was going to be the case. They were assured of them, is the way the New King James reads that. They embraced them and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. Now, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for He has prepared for them a city. And so you have this tremendous example, especially focused on Abraham and Sarah. They knew for sure that God's promises were true. They didn't view this world as their home. We have that great old song that we sing, "This world is not my home, I'm just passing through. My treasures are laid up somewhere beyond the blue." And that's exactly their perspective. That's the way they saw things. That was their viewpoint. And as I said, faith is so much a viewpoint. It's the way that you see things. They didn't desire to go back to where they started from. They would have had opportunity, no doubt. Abraham, Sarah, the patriarchs, all could have gone back to that homeland. But they were spiritual adventurers, following the promises of God, following His leading by faith, no matter where it took them. Here's the attitude they had. They didn't want to go back. They were seeking a heavenly home. One of the things that's not said specifically so much if you read the text in Genesis, for instance, is the expectation that these people had of an afterlife. But what the Hebrew writer is telling us is it's all over their actions. It's seen in the way that they behaved. It's plain that they're looking for something beyond this life, having not experienced maybe everything that they would have liked in this life. They still expected those things to be fulfilled, and they knew that something better even yet was coming. And so this world was not their home. This world can't be our home either. If our attitude is, God, we believe You, and we're going to do whatever we need to do, give up whatever we need to give up, leave whatever we need to leave in order to please You in this life, we'll have the reward that He has promised. What the text says is, because when people have this attitude, how does God feel about them? He's not ashamed to be called their God. I mean, here we are, who we are, mere mortal, sometimes sinful human beings, but trying to live by faith, and He's not ashamed to be called our God. What a tremendous statement. And as a consequence of that, what has He prepared? A city. So there's a place to go beyond this life that's prepared for us. John says in Revelation 21 and verse 2, I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. I believe that's a symbolic picture, the very thing that these people of faith were looking for, the heavenly hope. Do you have comments or questions on Abraham, Sarah to this point? We'll talk about some more things about Abraham in just a minute.
They sacrificed a lot to embrace that vision.
Yes. And although we understand that, you know, Abraham was a pretty wealthy man for his day when he got to Canaan, he left a lot of comforts behind. I'm very certain about that. Dwelling in tents, it will be mentioned, you know, and that sort of thing, living that nomadic kind of life where there's no doubt about it that back where he was, he could, you know, could have stayed there and lived in somewhat peace and luxury for the time. But he just left all that behind. We need to understand that typically faith does require sacrifice, but it's not even viewed as being sacrificed to those who make it. You never read Abraham complaining about, you know, the life that he's living. And it's not like he's always seeking. You know, your thing comes up, and I'm going to get off track here a little bit. But between Abraham and Lot, even in that situation where Abraham was in a situation where he could make his, you know, existence a little easier and take the well-watered plain and all that sort of thing, it didn't matter to him. You know, that's not what life is about to him. And it's such a huge, a great example for us. All right, let's go on and talk about this next little section. I should have that up already. How that by faith Abraham offers Isaac. Let's read in verse 17. By faith Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. And he who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, "In Isaac your seed shall be called," concluding that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from which he also received him in a figurative sense. When you read the story of Abraham, we've seen that the promises are made that God would make of him a great nation, give to his descendants a land in which to dwell. Isaac was the one through whom that covenant was going to be made, going to come to fruition. If you look in Genesis chapter 17 and verse 19, the promises are first told in Genesis 12, have partially repeated in Genesis 15. When you come to Genesis 17, in verse 19, God tells Abraham, "You shall call his name Isaac," talking about the birth of the child. "You shall call his name Isaac, and I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant." So God is plain that it is Isaac through whom the promises that I've made to you are going to come to pass. So here, Isaac is born. He comes up, is of some age, is old enough to walk and talk and bear burdens. By the time he's not just a little, you know, infant child. And God tells him now you take this son, the son of promise, and you go to Mount Moriah, or to Moriah, and sacrifice him. Anybody see a problem with that? Isaac hasn't had any children yet. How are you going to have a multitude of descendants from Isaac if you kill him? What does Abraham think? It's in God's hands. If God tells me to kill him, I'm going to kill him. And God can raise him up or do whatever he wants to. I'm trusting God to keep his promise to me, even though from a human standpoint, it couldn't possibly be done. That he could have, you know, a multitude of descendants. And so here's what faith is. You see the problem. A lot of times you'll see the problem, well, God, if I do that, I see you plainly are telling me this. If I do this, I don't see how I'm going to get that. And you can just go through the Sermon on the Mount. All of the things that Jesus tells us to do and not do. And see how many of those things, if you really live that out in your life, how many of those things, doing those things, I often think about, you know, turning the other cheek. I don't see how that's going to work out for me. I don't understand how that's going to work out for my best. And you just go, all of the things that we're just asked to do them by faith, to trust God, to trust His promises, and it'll happen. That's what Abraham is able to do in this case. And so he takes Isaac to Moriah, and as good as sacrifices him, has the knife in his hand to kill him with, has him, you know, ready for the flames, and he's stopped by an angel. And God is given, by the way, interestingly, a new name in the Old Testament on that occasion. Does anybody know what it is? The Lord will provide. It's the first time we see Jehovah Jireh in the Old Testament. The Lord will provide. The Lord will take care of it. We see that by faith. Another little interesting thing about that story is the place where the sacrifice occurred. Most all scholars who study that would agree, and this is not only in scholars who would consider it to be from as Christians, but Jewish and even Muslim scholars, I think, would agree that the place where Abraham did this act, Mount Moriah, is the exact place on which the temple was later built, where sacrifices were done. It's kind of a fascinating thing. I have a sermon on that sometime. Maybe I'll preach the connection between all of that. In any case, you have this tremendous act of faith. Abraham reasons that God could raise up Isaac from the dead. And then you have just some mention of some of the things. Again, he's not giving us every example that could be given, obviously, from the Old Testament, but you have some mention of some of the things that the patriarchs themselves did, as we call them. He says, by faith Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. And we remember the story where, you know, Esau has sold his birthright, and then Isaac's getting ready to die, and Jacob comes in and fakes like he's Esau and steals the blessing, so to speak, and earns his name of supplanter as a result of that. But he gets the blessing from his father, and the Esau comes in later, and his father says, you know, sorry, I already blessed your younger brother, he's got the blessing. But if you go back and read, and let's take just a real quick moment to do that, look at Genesis chapter 27. And you see in verse 27, here's the blessing that Isaac gives to Jacob. He came near and kissed him, and he smelled the smell of his clothing, blessed him, and he said, surely the smell of my son is like the smell of a field which the Lord has blessed. Therefore, may God give you of the dew of heaven, of the fatness of the earth, plenty of grain and wine. Let people serve you. Nations bow down to you. Be master over your brethren. Let your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you, and blessed be those who bless you. So he says some things there about Jacob and his descendants that are going to put he and his descendants in a place of ruling, in a place of dominance, a place of being very highly blessed in the future. And the point is, in saying this, he is trusting that God will make that so. There's a lot of faith in making this sort of declaration. When Esau comes in later, and the blessing he gives to Esau is in verse 39, your dwelling shall be of the fatness of the earth, of the dew of the heaven from above. By your sword you shall live, and you shall serve your brother. That's a whole different sort of blessing. In fact, it's pretty close to being a curse, because that was all he had left to give him. But both of the statements concerning the future of these sons obviously took a lot of faith to make. I don't know about how we think about that. I think there was some guidance of God, of course, with these men being patriarchs and God speaking perhaps. Well, not just perhaps, but we know he did speak directly to the patriarchs. Maybe that Jacob knew from what God had told him some things that are going to happen. I don't know how you think, though, about the future of your children, your grandchildren. You ever thought to pray about their future when you're gone? I expect maybe some of us have. How do you feel? How strongly do you believe that God will heed those prayers? You know, there's a very similar sort of, it's not exactly the same thing, but the very similar sort of action of faith that those of us who are parents and grandparents might involve ourselves in even today. Well, you go from Isaac blessing Jacob and Esau, Jacob blessing the sons of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh. Why would he do that? They're considered as his own sons, the text says. And you can read, you know, here in Hebrews 11, by faith Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each one of the sons of Joseph and worshipped, leaning on the top of his staff. There's a translation thing. If you go back to the Old Testament, some of the translations have the top of his bedpost or something, but same kind of idea. By faith Joseph, in verse 22, by faith Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the departure of the children of Israel and gave instructions concerning his bones. Let's talk about this for a minute. Again, a story we may not be as familiar with as we are in some of the things in Joseph's life. If you wanted to pick out, for instance, from the life of Joseph, just think about him just for a minute with me. Think about the life of Joseph. Can anybody think, besides what's mentioned here, come up with some deeds of faith in the life of Joseph? Can anybody come up with a few of those? I think I could. I think I could come up with some pretty good ones. Including the, you know, here he's living by faith when he rejects Potiphar's wife. He's living by faith while he's stuck in that prison. Lots of things. He continues to trust God, you know, through all of this. And if it were to Steve Klein's human reasoning, maybe the last example that I would ever have thought of is the one that's mentioned here, which just shows you the guidance of the Holy Spirit. He picks out this one, what we might think is a pretty small thing. But Joseph is dying, and he makes the Israelites there in Egypt vow to him to do what? Take his bones back to the promised land when they go. When they go. When are they going to go? About 400 years later. It's about 400 years later. And it's just, you think about, you know, what that says. He knows God has promised to give them that land, you see. He knows that. And so he knows they are going to go back. He may not know the time frame, but when you go back, you got to take my bones with you and bury them back there. And if you go to the book of Judges, in Judges, or rather Joshua, I'm sorry, Joshua 24, they take his bones back. When they get into Canaan, they bury his bones in a parcel of ground that was bought by Jacob. Y'all put all that together. That's one of those really long-lasting, you talk about a durable deed, the deed on that property lasted 400 years, I guess, and he takes it back, and he's buried, you know, in the tomb of his father, in the land, on the land of his father, all hundreds of years later. But he knew that was going to happen, that his people were going to go back there, that land that his father bought all those years ago was still going to be in his family. And that's where he's taken, that's where he's buried. It's an amazing story. All three of these men trusted God with the unseen future of their children. That's really the story. Again, what's faith? Evidence of things hoped for, conviction of things not seen. Not seen. So you see the tremendous example of faith. Questions or other thoughts to add into that? Okay? Let's go on to the next lesson, which is lesson 18, or 19, I'm sorry, in your lesson material. And continuing on examples of faith, and I just titled this one, Of Whom the World Was Not Worthy. They're living by faith, and truly the world is not worthy of such folks. We're going to look at Moses and his parents, first of all, starting in Hebrews 11 and verse 23. By faith, Moses, it sounds like it's going to talk about the faith of Moses, but it's really about the faith of his parents. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child and they were not afraid of the king's command. What was the king's command? Kill all the Hebrew males, okay? That all of them were to be killed. They were becoming too numerous. He was threatened by their presence, so he's going to have all of the Hebrew males killed. Well, when it says they weren't afraid of the king's command, they were aware of it, they knew, but they weren't going to kill their son, were they? No. They were going to, they knew that wasn't right. They were going to do what God wanted them to do and not what, you know, some pagan king wanted them to do. And in that sense, they weren't afraid of his command. And the fact that, as any parent will tell you, their child's a beautiful child. So Moses is seen as a beautiful child, and they're not going to kill their child, no matter what the king might say, living by faith. Of course, what happens is we know the story, we tell it to our children. 3 months, he's hidden in the bulrushes by the river. Pharaoh's daughter comes down, decides that she wants the baby, and takes it and keeps it, but tells Miriam is standing nearby, and she has her go fetch a nurse for the baby, and so Moses winds up being raised when he was very young by his own mother. Okay, and his parents, by the way, who had all of this faith, not mentioned in this text, what were their names? Amram and Jochebed. Okay, two really must have been tremendous folks to have their names mentioned in this, or not names, but their deeds mentioned in this great roll call. He is raised eventually in the household of Pharaoh as Pharaoh's daughter's son. What kind of a life did he have? Yeah, everything he wanted. You know, the riches of Egypt are still famous even today. You know, if the King Tut's tomb, you know, riches and sarcophagus and everything travel around and people come from miles around, see all that. A priceless fortune. He had access to all of that. And yet it says in verse 24 that by faith Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. By faith he kept the Passover with the sprinkling of blood, lest he who destroyed the firstborn should touch him. So first of all, he refuses to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Again, having access to all of this wealth, he was, the text in Acts chapter 7, as Stephen recounts part of the life of Moses, tells us that he was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in words and deeds, yet he gives up that life as Egyptian royalty in order to what? Go on vacation? To say, suffer affliction. In order to suffer affliction with the people of God. We need to have this attitude, folks. We would rather suffer with each other, headed toward heaven, going through difficulties together, than enjoy what the world has to offer, no matter what that might be. That we would rather be with the people of God, have our name as a reproach, be sneered at as all those old, you know, as we are in the denominational world, those old Church of Christ people think they're the only ones going to heaven, all that kind of stuff. Rather have that kind of reproach and all of that than to enjoy what the world has to offer. Here's a man who's living by faith, who gave it all up to be with a bunch of slaves and to live among them and suffer affliction with them. And he did it because, again, it's a viewpoint. What's valuable to you? Faith sees things in a certain way. He, it says, esteemed the reproach of Christ. Let's think about that phrase for just a little bit. Reproach of Christ. What's reproach? What's reproach mean? Rejection? Saying bad things about you? Okay. That sort of thing. The reproach of Christ was better in his mind than the treasures of Egypt. That's his viewpoint. It's a viewpoint that faith gave him. Now, I don't know how much Moses knew exactly about Christ at that stage in his life. He would later make a prophecy concerning the coming of the prophet that all were to listen to. But he had faith in God. If he understood the promises at this point, which I believe he would have, he knew that through Abraham's seed, what would happen? All the nations of the earth would be blessed. So he might have had a concept right then and there, if he knew that, and I believe he did. He believed that, and the text indicates that he did. Then that God is, through his nation, through his people, going to bring somebody seed, one seed, Christ, Paul says in Galatians, through whom all would be blessed. Very well could be that Moses has all of that in his head when he says, you know what, I don't want Egypt. I want to be with the people of God. The reproach, there, you see why it might be called the reproach of Christ then? Even in the mind of Moses, although he wouldn't have had the name Christ in his mind, the concept of the seed that would come, that was promised to his forefathers. Looks like that may all be working in this case. He forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king. He endured as, what's the phrase? Seeing, it's amazing. Seeing him who is invisible. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. God wants us to have faith in him. Somebody says, well, if God would just, show up one time, if he would just appear by my bedside, then I'd have, well, that's seeing. He doesn't ask us to see. He asks us to believe. Okay, and Bernie was making a good point the other night. When we believe, then we see. That's really what this is saying. Belief comes, then we see. Then we see through our faith, through our belief. All right. In this text, he goes on, he forsakes Egypt, he keeps the Passover. What does he think is going to happen if he doesn't keep the Passover? If he doesn't put the blood on the lintel and the doorpost and eat the lamb, what's going to happen? Firstborn's going to die. Moses believes that. The Israelites believe that. It says, by faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, lest he who destroyed the firstborn should touch them. Moses knows that God has said this is going to happen. He believes that that's exactly what's going to happen. And again, I'm not running my clicker like I need to. So he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, chose to suffer, esteemed the reproach of Christ greater riches, saw him who is invisible, kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood. Let's go on. They talk about in the next verse 29, the Israelites passing through the Red Sea. By faith they passed through the Red Sea as by dry land, whereas the Egyptians attempting to do so were drowned. We know the story, amazing story of God, causing the strong east wind to come and parting the sea for them and them walking through on dry land with the walls of water on each side. The Egyptians trying to do so drown in the sea and utterly destroyed. I don't think that's a real picture. It looked like it might be. It was not in outer space taking a picture of them crossing the Red Sea, but that's somebody's concept of how that may have been, and it looks pretty good to me. Yes, Rahab knew it. And we'll get to her in just a couple of verses, but that was one of the things. When we think about her, by faith, she received the spies. Faith in believing the great and mighty works of God that she'd heard about and what that must mean about the God of the Israelites. She had a tremendous amount of faith in the God of the Israelites, although she was a foreigner, a citizen of Jericho. And speaking of which, by faith the walls of Jericho fell down. They were marched around once each day, as the song goes, for 6 days, seven times on the seventh day. Everybody had to be quiet, and then finally, in that seventh circumference, on the seventh day, They shout, the walls of Jericho fall down. Of course, all of that recorded in Joshua 6 and following. What you're seeing on the right are some pictures of Tel Jericho from that time period. Among other things here, that's the, kind of an overview of the city. This is a, it's hard to tell what you're seeing right there, but that's looking down from space on top of the, looking straight down at the tell. Here's a guy standing by a revetment wall. The way the, what archaeologists have found is there was a retaining wall, and then there was a wall on top of that that went this way. So there's this retaining wall that's on the earth, basically. And then you have a wall that's like this. And the man that you see in the right-hand corner there is Dr. Bryant Wood of the University of Toronto. And he's done quite a bit of work there. But the wall falls, the upper wall falls like this over the revetment wall. And every man goes up. You ever notice that in the text in Joshua? Every man went up into the city. Had to go up a little hill to walk up that revetment wall over which the upper walls had fallen. Okay. Archaeology verifies the biblical account there very well. There's a number of other things that archaeologists have found that go along with that. I won't get into that this morning, but by faith, the walls fell down. One of the points I think Lauren was making the other night, which I wanted to reemphasize as well, this what faith is all about. What we're trying to understand is what faith is all about. The Lord, in Joshua 6 and verse 2, tells Joshua, he says, "See, I have given you Jericho into your hand, its king and the mighty men. You shall march around the city, all you men of war. You shall go around the city once. This you shall do 6 days," and go on. He goes on and tells him about this. So God says, here's the point. God says, "I have given you the city. Now you go march around it, you know, 6 days and then seven times on the seventh day. Wait a minute, God, I thought you already gave it to me. So why do I have to go do anything? What happens if the Israelites don't march around Jericho? It's not going to fall, is it? I think everybody understands that. God says, there you go. We believe in God. God says, okay, I'm giving you salvation. Well, why do I have to be baptized then? It's exactly the same principle. Here's how faith operates. Faith operates in action. God says, it's a gift. Now, there are a lot of people, most of the people in the religious world today say, well, it's a gift. You don't have to do anything for it. Did they have to do anything for Jericho? That's a gift. You might still have to do something. Meet a condition. You're not working for it. You don't earn it. Paul's very plain about that, Romans 4 and so on and so forth. But you might have to meet a condition that demonstrates your faith. That's what it's all about. And Jericho's a supreme example of that. So a great one to use because of that language. People talk about being saved by grace. Grace is giving, right? It's a gift. Jericho was received by grace. It was a gift. They still had to do something. By faith, Rahab received the spies. Here's another great example of this. If you look at Hebrews 11 and verse 31, by faith the harlot Rahab did not perish with those who did not believe when she had received the spies with peace. So Rahab demonstrates her faith. Again, what we were just talking about a minute ago, she'd heard the stories. She knew about the what they'd done to Sihon and Og and so on and so forth, and probably the parting of the Red Sea and all of that sort of thing. She knew all of that. She believes in their God. And she receives them and protects them by faith. That's an example in Hebrews 11. By faith she did that. What's it an example of in James chapter 2? The exact same thing. You see that Rahab was justified by faith in Hebrews, works in James. What does that teach us? Are faith and works two different things? They go together. They go together. Rahab received her justification by faith that worked, and not until her faith worked. Same with Jericho. Wasn't received until faith worked. These are tremendous lessons to help us understand the meaning of faith in our lives, and I hope you all are I know many of you are mature Christians, studied this many times probably, but I hope that you're being revitalized to understand how faith must work in your life. And also, so that you can talk to neighbors and friends about this, because the world, the religious world, is extremely confused about how faith works in man's salvation. Don't understand that what the principle of faith is all about. Hebrews 11, I'm going to quit here in just a second, but just let me just say this. Every person of faith in Hebrews 11 did something. Nobody, faith, the idea that you can just have this mental assent, oh yeah, I believe that Jesus is and you're saved, that's not how faith works. All right, we're going to go on from there next time and into lesson 20 as well.